I always joked around this with kids. I'm not going to, as a head coach, I'm not going to offer you a scholarship until you're ready to say yes when I do.
That was Kerry Keating. He was the head men's basketball coach at Santa Clara, a longtime Division I assistant. He's the VP at the consulting firm JMI Sports and an NBA studio analyst. And he's today's guest. Welcome to Dan Dickow's Quarantine Series on the Scorebook Live Today podcast. As the world of sports is shut down due to the coronavirus, we're ramping things up a notch here at Scorebook Live. Every weekday, Dan interviews an expert in the world of sports, from star hoopers and coaches like Steve Kerr, Jamal Crawford, and Doug Christie, to seven-time Mr. Olympia bodybuilder Phil Heath. We hope you're entertained and maybe learn a thing or two as we navigate these uncertain times. The easiest way to tune in is by subscribing. In addition to our weekly Washington High School Sports News and Conversation podcast released Thursdays, hosted by myself, Andy Bueller, fellow reporter Todd Millis, Dan is bringing you interviews just like this one delivered 5 days a week. Head to wherever you get your podcasts, subscribe for free, and while you're there, leave a review. We'd love to hear from you. Before we get to Dan's interview today, a word from our sponsor. This podcast is brought to you by Washington Federal. Washington Federal is a local bank and portfolio lender with more than 200 branches across 8 states, more than 32,000 fee-free ATMs, 24/7 online and mobile banking with drive-up ATMs. Washington Federal is a proud sponsor of Scorebook Live. They care deeply about high school sports and the communities that support them across the entire state of Washington. Head to WFDBank.com to learn how they can help you meet your financial goals. That's WAFDBank.com. Washington Federal, a neighbor you can count on. We hope everybody's staying safe and healthy. We're just as excited for high school sports to return as you are. Now, Dan Dickow.
Dan Dickow, Scorebook Live, Washington, continuing with our quarantine series during these uncertain times in our nation and in our world. Typically bring you once a week podcast. We've been up in our game where we have a conversation with the expert in the world of sports. Today's guest is fits that bill extremely well. A longtime coach at the college level, an assistant on some very good teams. Both at UCLA, Tennessee, Vanderbilt, Seton Hall, to name a few. West Coast basketball fans will also know him as a longtime head coach down at Santa Clara in the WCC, and I'm sure we will hear some Gonzaga-Santa Clara war stories at some point in this conversation. Want to welcome in Coach Kerry Keating. Coach, how is life down in the Bay Area for you and your family?
It's all good, man. It's as best as it can be. I appreciate you having me on. Excited to chat with you today. Yeah, we've personally been preparing for this inadvertently because we've been working out of the house since leaving Santa Clara as a gig economist, if you will. You know, we're all much like yourself in that startup world and trying to build businesses, and fortunately been able to insert ourselves into that ecosystem down here. Luckily was placed here as a head coach and then fought to stay here to keep access to what is an unbelievably rich area for ideas, thoughts, venture, obviously, entrepreneur, the deal flow, solutions. And I think what's really been prevalent for me in these last 2 months, Dan, is the companies that I've tried to help out were more sport-related, obviously with the background, my father being a longtime athletic director in Division I and obviously my 25 years of coaching. That Rolodex became valuable to a lot of these companies who are looking to get attached to it. And you never thought you could make a business out of that. And that's clearly what we set out to do. But what has been evident for me in the last 2 months was the amount of solutions that can come out of the mines here in Silicon Valley. And that's not, you know, unique to this area, but it's unique in the amount of people that can contribute to that. And we clearly are in a position now as a country, as a race, to find more solutions to now exist in what's going to become part of our daily routine. You know, to what extent, we don't know. And that's been similar to the coaching part, a challenge. You're always trying to present your staff, yourself, your team with ways to meet challenges. And the parallel has been there, both in building this business and being a coach of sorts to executives and startups, but now in trying to work with them and now working with a new company, which we'll chat about, to help even find bigger solutions for bigger clients, if you will, on the collegiate level to help get themselves back to operating again soon.
Relationships helped propel your new career maybe quicker than you might have expected. And I've found that to be so true in talking to many coaches and executives over the past couple of weeks with this Scorebook Live Washington project, is that your networks many times lead to your new opportunities and you don't know when they're about to come. That can be so true in the world of coaching, whether you're recruiting a high school player or you're finding a way to fill out your coaching staff. You were a part of recruiting three Final Four teams at UCLA. You were only coaching on the floor with two of them because you had already left to go to Santa Clara for your head coaching opportunity. But when you looked at the relationships that you developed during the recruiting, what was the most important aspect in reaching out to the coaches, the parents, as well as the high school student athletes?
Well, in hindsight of what's transpired in the last two or three years, Dan, in college basketball, from a business perspective, and I'm clearly talking about all the things that have happened with the grassroots tangling into the payments moved here and there, like all the FBI stuff, it kind of gave me a little bit more of a sense of pride in how we went about doing our business over the course of my 25 years, but more specifically at UCLA because of the visibility that it provided. And that kind of started in earnest in my time at Tennessee, the stop that I had prior to UCLA, and even Tulsa prior to Tennessee, because Tulsa is where I started my relationship building on the West Coast, and in particular California, because at the time, Tulsa was a part of the old WAC conference with 16 teams. And I think it was a half of all of the athletes in the conference, but a third at Tulsa were from California or a neighboring state. So there was a, you know, you're in Oklahoma, but it's very much West Coast dominated. So I started to recruit Lewis Amundson, who went on to become a pro. No one knew about it, Colorado. We actually got Jamal Williams committed, you know, former Husky and Lobo. We got him committed at Tulsa because we ended up leaving after 1 year, so we never got a chance to coach this crew. We got Jamal committed to us from Corona, California. We went out and were recruiting a point guard out of Irvine, Jeff Gloger. So I was kind of using that as a way to bring people in. Now, what that did is exactly what you referenced. It started a cadence of relationship building that was literally built on trust and opportunity. Because we were following Bill Self at Tulsa in a team that was 4 points away, or at least one game away. I know it was an Elite Eight, and a loss to North Carolina from going to the Final Four. That thrust him into an opportunity to go to Illinois. Buzz and I had been at Appalachian State, Buzz Peterson, together, where we went to two championship and an NCAA tournament appearance. So I went with Buzz, and we had this majority of this team left over that had just gotten on the door of the Final Four and had this incredible bravado about them and confidence. And it was just plug and play for us. We ended up winning the NIT that year with a team that we didn't recruit at all. And really what I saw as the opportunity was this two-year run that we were going to have with this group, both prior and current. And I needed to go tell these kids how to replace them. So it was about an honest effort to kind of paint a picture and set the table for, one, how we do things from an academic standpoint, how Buzz runs his program from a family standpoint, and really the opportunity to play that was going to be there because we were getting ready to lose a majority of that team to graduation. That ended up moving to Tennessee after 8 months at Tulsa, and my very first signee at Tennessee was also the very first pro I ever signed with C.J. Watson from Bishop Gorman in Las Vegas. And again, now I'm even further away, but I have these relationships that are so strong out in California. The first guy we get is from Las Vegas on a California-based team. At the time, the rules were still open for anyone to play with anybody. had a kid from Maryland and Montana, and you know, they were all over the place. There's no state border. But CJ played for the pump team that was LA based, and it really kind of established me as someone that could come in without any premonition of handouts or side deals or trying to skirt around getting to a guy. It was all up front and all honest from the very, very beginning. There was nothing that needed to get done except build a relationship built on trust. You know, and CJ saw that. You know, CJ had a chance to go to UCLA. Certainly UNLV was recruiting him. Fresno was recruiting because Tark had left UNLV to go to Fresno. But it was, you know, we turned down Deron Williams to take CJ. You know, Deron Williams went on to be a pretty good pro himself. And oddly enough, and I think back about this, Dan, that relationship was also built squarely around 9/11. The first day you could go see the kids in the fall was September 9th. And I saw CJ on September 10th and flew a red eye back on September 11th. 2001, and our plane was taking off from Atlanta as it got grounded, right as the towers got hit, the planes got grounded. But my point is, the whole thing was built around this traumatic event that's a part of CJ's life now and a part of these next generation's life, part of my life, because I grew up in New York and had people, like the Twin Towers are fabric of my existence, right? So I'm thinking about it now and dealing with this and just hindsight being cyclical of how we were able to forge this. Because this was the very start of me recruiting pros to Tennessee. And then of course, having to recruit them at UCLA, it was built upon this human element of, you know, controversy and tragedy. And I think it strengthened our relationship. Obviously CJ went on to have a great career at Tennessee, had a great pro career, is now an author, back in Las Vegas, very active in his community. But then it led to, you know, having to recruit Kevin Love when he's 14 years old. Like seeing him as a ninth grader and going and telling Ben, hey, I know this is going to sound crazy. We're playing Michigan State on Saturday. This was in December at the Les Schwab on University of Oregon at Portland's campus. And I said, Ben, I know we're not very good. This is our first year and stuff. But this kid would start for us Saturday. And Ben was like, get out of here. I'm like, Ben, I'm just telling you. So what I was able to do, Dan, on the basis of relationship building out of trust was, especially in the case of Ben, I think really develop an ability to evaluate kids and how they could exist in a program, how they could play in a certain style, how they could exist with other coaches on our staff, with the other players. Just an overall evaluation of where they really fit in to put them in the best position to succeed. And I'll give you a perfect example of that. We had a guy come in our office the next year that I was very well aware of, name not important, who I knew what he was in the office for. And he got there that day before I did. He was sitting outside Ben's office. And I remember like it was yesterday. And I pulled Doug Erickson, he's been there forever. He's been the office forward, so even back to the 95 championship. And I said, Doug, what is he doing here? Well, he came to see, he wanted to talk to Coach. I said, do yourself a favor. Go back out and tell him Coach's plans changed and he can't talk to you today because we're not taking that kid. It was O.J. Mayo. And I said, we are not recruiting him. And all due respect, I'm not saying he's a bad player, but for all the things that are involved and going on right now with OJ Mayo, I'm not even going to have this conversation with Ben because I understand what's going on. And this is not something Ben needs to even try to understand. Just a small example. It happens all the time, especially in LA, but I kind of felt this ability to assess situations that were not going to put Ben as a head coach in a position to essentially waste time to develop efficiency. And I think it had a big part of our success in helping him become a better coach for the guys that we had. And look, no one's been to three straight Final Fours since. So I look back on that with a lot of pride. I think it carries over now, and I'll finish on this and let's move, but because I could talk forever on it. I think it carries over now into what's important in startups, what's important for scale, getting ready to pivot. As you mentioned, you've made a little bit of a pivot and to use technological terms. I think there's direct correlations in assessing things, and the value that I've been able to bring is to a CEO, to a startup, to a CEO of any company is see what happens or what could happen 4 or 5 steps down the road as a result of this decision. Prepare to maybe take that pivot, but help them maybe get to that point and all the steps in between while staying present in the moment. And I'm so fortunate to have had those opportunities with some great coaches and now working with some great CEOs, and looking forward to what the next step could be, whether it means going back to coaching or staying in business. And with the new opportunity that recently came up, maybe that business track is the right way to go, even though can't get too far away because it's sport related in all aspects.
Yeah, I love some of the stories that you told about the relationships allowing you, I don't want to say access to players, but knowledge of players and the ability to kind of get to know them a little bit more and if they fit. I want to kind of ask you about the difference as a assistant coach versus a head coach in how you go about evaluating players and then offering a scholarship once you're sold. Because I can only imagine that as an assistant coach, you kind of have to cast a wide net. And then you have to pare it down and say to the head coach, okay, you know what? We saw 150 kids, but these 10 are the ones we absolutely have to focus on because they fit the culture we want to build, the style of play we want to have, and they're great kids and great families. Am I right? How do you go about differentiating that?
Inevitably, what starts the process is the player's talent, because at the end of the day, that's what's going to be the deciding factor. But as you mentioned, there's so many other things that come into play even before you get to that decision. Once you establish that, there's talent to evaluate. From a basic talent standpoint, and Ben really forced me to look at it this way even more so than Buzz did, because keep in mind now, Buzz is a product of the Carolina family. Famously went to school at the same exact time as Michael Jordan in the same position. I won't hold that personally against him, but the access that he had to evaluations unknowingly at the highest level as a player and both as a developed program at Carolina, I think help evaluate that talent in terms of, and again, Ben kind of put this on steroids. I developed what I thought would be the right way to evaluate for Ben is when I'm watching a game, look, I'm not the only one that does this. There's guys that watch body language, that watch interaction with their teammates. There's famously guys that want to watch warm-ups to see, because that's what that head coach may value. Like, I got to be honest, if I go watch a kid in Vegas at 8 o'clock in the morning and I want to get there at 7:30 to see if he's the first one in the gym, well, come on, there's other factors involved in that. Who's driving him to the gym and is he really going to be there? But if for some reason all of a sudden he gets himself there, his parents are dedicated ahead of the van, he wants to get reps in, okay, maybe that tells me something. But to be honest with you, Ben wasn't that concerned about that. Like, that's not going to be a deciding factor to Ben. Like, well, was he sitting on the bench and slapping his five to all of his teammates? Was he, you know, flipping off the coach? Well, yeah, I mean, there's attitude stuff you can always bring up. And then by and large, you want to have, obviously, team-first attitudes. But you got to kind of focus on what's important for the head coach. And Dan, for me, what it became from a physical basketball standpoint was, can the kid pass the ball? And I mean, like, can he literally pass the ball, like actually pass it, like snap a chest pass into someone's shooting pocket? Can he feed the post? Can he jump stop shot fake and dish it to a back cut? Can he jump stop, turn around, and hit a spaced three-point shooter? Like, can he pass? There's a lot that goes into that. It's basically, for me, if he could do that, that guy knew how to play. Like that to me was the deciding factor. There's everything else involved. Certainly his physical attributes, his quickness, his speed, his toughness, his shooting mechanics. Yes, they all came. But the deciding factor for me to move a guy from just that general list to like the next tier to where, okay, now I feel confident to go to Ben and say, you know what? Because we didn't offer scholarships. The head coach does that. Like, I always laugh when assistant coaches do that. And it's not a sign of weakness as much as just trying to gain a little bit of strength of the offer. Like, yeah, we're serious. We're going to offer you a scholarship. Look, I always joked around this with kids. I'm not going to, as a head coach, I'm not going to offer you a scholarship until you're ready to say yes when I do. Because we're going to put a lot of effort into this that I don't want to be one of five. I want to be the one. You may bring five schools, but me offering you a scholarship to me is like bringing the ring and getting on a knee. Like, I expect you to say yes when I propose, right? I don't expect to say, let me think about that. I got five others I want to think of. Like, I get the process, but my point of the whole thing is to go back to me as an assistant. I wasn't out there offering scholarships. Like, the most famous one in hindsight is the Russell Westbrook deal. The understanding of our roster as an assistant, and I'll jump a little bit, but it'll prove the point if you follow. Darren Collison's family has known me since I was knee-high to the ground because his parents went to a college that my dad was the athletic director back in the 80s on Long Island. They were Olympic sprinters, and they were foreigners, and my dad did everything he could to take care of them. They respected that. That's our family fabric. The one time I saw Darren play in the Martin Luther King Classic at Riverside in the middle of January, his mom, who, by the way, is one of the best sprinters ever, Jackie Joyner-Kersee, they all had this level of respect for June Collison. And she comes up, she says, "Are you Larry's son?" And I said, "Yes." She goes, "Oh, my." She starts going crazy in the gym. "We're going to UCLA. This is great." And I'm like, "Whoa, whoa, whoa. I just saw Darren play for the first time and told his AAU coach, I can't talk to you. I really like him." My point being is I didn't say, "Yeah, we're going to offer him a scholarship," because I felt, "Oh, my goodness, if I don't do that, she's going to get turned off that we don't want him." I had to evaluate Darren to the point where I could bring him to the doorstep to where Ben offers a scholarship and he says yes. Because that's what I would want my assistants to do at that level. It's a little bit harder at the lower levels because you don't have that luxury of being a blue blood school or a GU where you can say take it or leave it, or Tommy's going to go find the next French guy to take your spot tomorrow, right? So, you know, in the case of Darren, fast forward to him now as a player. I can't tell you one time that I sat in my office with Darren Collison and broke down a film and talked about basketball. I really can't, because it wasn't really necessary, and it was more needed that he and I just talked. Whenever he came in, we would just talk about his classes and his social life and, you know, just life. Just we had a familial bond, obviously, that goes back to our parents. But then he and I, obviously, fast forward, and he was integral in that game in Oakland, by the way, in 06, that I'm sure we'll touch on just a little bit. I don't want to piss too many people off up there. But my point is, as an assistant, I was able to carry over the trust into relationships. In the case of Russell, it was an assessment of knowing that, one, we knew Jordan Farmar was going to leave after a sophomore year. Come hell or high water, we already went to a Final Four with him as a freshman. For him, it was like, how fast can I be a pro? That was his ego. That was his mentality. We were buying time with him. We knew we'd have to replace him in the spring with someone. What we didn't realize was the competitive nature between Aaron Afalo and Jordan Farmar, of Aaron going like, "Well, if he's going pro, I'm going pro," happened in a day, because we didn't expect Aaron to leave. Jordan declares. The next day, Aaron declares. And all of a sudden, it's like, Ben's, "Oh, no." And I'm like, "No, we're good." Because back in September, Chris Carlson, our administrative assistant, who went on to be the head coach at UC San Diego, an administrator in the WCC, and now an assistant associate AD at UCLA, he introduced me to Reggie Morris, back to your whole relationship point. Of all the time I spent in L.A., I never dealt with Reggie Morris Jr. Chris had. He picks up the phone, introduces me to Reggie. We're on the staff together, and I basically said to Reggie, "Here's the deal. I saw Russell over the summer. I like what I'm seeing. Tell me more about him." He gives me the whole background. I said, "Here's what you got to do. I can't sit here and tell you we're going to give him a scholarship, because, one, I don't do that. Ben can't do it because UCLA is not going to let us oversign because we're already allotted. But I guarantee you we'll have a scholarship open in the spring. Trust me when I tell you. I can't tell you how, why, but you just got to trust me on that one." Chris vouches for it. Reggie tells the family. And every evaluation that I made on Russell that year, the allotted, I think, was like six or seven times we could go. Every time I went, it had nothing to do with the fact that he was out there kicking everyone's ass and just a bat out of hell trying to prove everybody wrong. And here comes Miami. Here comes Creighton, Kent State, Wake Forest, Arizona State, all the ones that had scholarships open. They hear UCLA's recruiting them. They're showing up in the gym. And then when I show up, they all kind of drop their head. I'm like, I'm not saying we're going to take him. I'm just here. I'm not even here to tell you how good he is. Every time I was in that gym, his little brother, Ray, who's now his business partner, and his parents just, thanks for coming. Thank you. It was all like, I'm just here to show support and let you know that I wasn't full of it. I'm going to keep coming throughout the year. Truth be known, Jordan declares, Aaron declares. I think it was the next week we had a home visit set up when it opened up in April. We go into the home. Ben had only seen him one time during the year because he didn't do a lot of evaluations during the season. But he trusted where I was at, mostly based off the other evaluations I already made to that point athletically. And Russell commits shortly thereafter. The rest of that is obviously history. And then Aaron comes back, and then we go to another Final Four and another one after that. So all of that was built just on an honesty and an upfront message of the bigger picture. And back to what I was saying before, Dan, about having the ability to see two or three steps ahead if it works out, paint that picture, and then work it along the line to get it to that point makes that endpoint, that commitment, so much more easier. I thought we had great success with that at UCLA, signing kids of different calibers, number one in the country, unheralded, guys like Luke Bamute, who were us, Virginia Tech, and South Carolina. I mean, it was such a hodgepodge, but all of those kids were there and could do one thing. They could play for Ben. Not everybody could do that. Not every kid was cut out to play for the intensity that Ben brought. And at the end of the day, the message was, listen, he's making you better. Look at all the guys he put into the NBA out of UCLA, the success he had. How it ended, notwithstanding, how I left and how things transpired after that, notwithstanding. The guy put UCLA in three straight Final Fours, which to this day has never happened anywhere else, and clearly is a really, really good coach. So, you know, knowing that and assessing that led to my head coaching philosophy on how we were going to recruit a little bit at Santa Clara.
I love that story about how Russell Westbrook came to be a UCLA Bruin. I played against him. This would have been going into my last year in the NBA. I was down at UCLA for the runs, the pickup runs, for a couple days one summer. And this was right after his freshman year. He didn't play a ton his freshman year. He played some, but not enough where somebody like myself knew him as a household name. And I matched up with him. And in between games, I just look at him, where'd you come from? Like, what did you do last year? Because I don't remember you. And we had a great conversation in between games and great conversation after we were done playing. And I remember walking out of the gym that day and be like, he's different. There's something about him. And the way he attacked current pros, the way he played hard, and then obviously you couple that with his athleticism and his skill level, I figured he was going to be pretty good. I didn't realize he was going to be as good as he was now. But I guess the question I want to get to is, how impactful are those UCLA runs in the summertime? Because you get the best pros in the world to go to UCLA. How impactful was that for you guys to help build your program?
Well, it's something that's been in existence there for a long, long time. I mean, it's there was a time where LA and Houston were the two biggest off-season destinations for NBA players. And naturally, it just fit that they would want to play in the off-season, and it became the men's gym. I think you probably played up in that men's gym, which was the old original gym that Coach Wooden coached in. And it just became a part of we didn't really have to sell that as much, because keep in mind too, Dan, our first class at UCLA were four LA kids. Paolo, Lorenzo Mata, Jordan Former, and Josh Shipp. So they kind of already understood LA. We didn't have to sell it any more than the team was kind of in a transitional period and the playing time was there. Now, as it grew and moved on towards recruiting outside the area a little bit more, that aspect of availability was intriguing to kids of the caliber of Luke Bamute, certainly what Russell did and took advantage of, because you just can't say at Michigan State or Duke or Kansas that you have this every summer like clockwork on your campus. You know, like it's an inadvertent built-in advantage that didn't need to be curated. It just needed to be massaged and built into the summer fabric of how we're going to go about keeping guys here for summer school. Because keep in mind, UCLA is a quarter school. So the school, it ends in June. It's one of the 10% of colleges, at least to my knowledge now, still a quarter school where it ends in June. So you're kind of pushing up against giving your guys some time away and off and getting them this opportunity to play in those runs too. It just naturally occurred that guys would want to stay there because we were having success. Why would you not want to be around that and keep getting better? And in the case of guys like Russell, kind of put it on steroids. Like, okay, I need this because I need to get better for my own purposes here, and I'm going to play against the best competition I can, which just so happens to also be NBA All-Stars coming in the gym. I mean, at that time, that cycle, and I think it's kind of, I wouldn't say devolved into what it is now, but at the height of it, which was in that time we were there, it was very much a tool that was utilized by our players more so than us having to sell it in recruiting. And remember now, the rules were such that they're not as lenient as they were now. We couldn't go in there and watch that. We couldn't go in there. I like to do it to connect with the Baron Davises and the former players that were coming through in there, the recent former players that were still playing, because it was just a way to connect with them. But what an unbelievable opportunity for our guys to prove themselves and for them to bring in, you know, I think what naturally happens is the AAU system broke down borders and created, you know, nationwide social friendships that became, okay, come on out to LA. And then it gave other guys the opportunity. Did it saturate it? I don't know, because I was gone at that time. But I think it's come back now to becoming more of a training ground and then a proving ground, as before it was more of a proving ground only. I think now it's a little bit more of a guys working guys out and working out with each other. You see a ton of videos of guys working out guys, the workout guys, right? Well, a lot of them are happening on that third court as the run's going on in the middle in the first court. So it's a little bit of a hybrid model right now that guys are taking advantage of. And I think, you know, Rico Hines, who's a graduate of there and now an NBA assistant, has kind of taken charge of overseeing that and putting guys in a position where they can utilize that. But there's also become that secondary training element of it too.
Yeah, I know Rico does a phenomenal job. Our paths crossed on a number of occasions during my playing career. But I want to go now to you as a head coach at Santa Clara. You probably, I can imagine, came in with very high expectations, goals, which I would do the same if I was coming in a position like that. But you're coming into the WCC that has a juggernaut in Gonzaga. And I got to know you a little bit while you were coaching at Santa Clara due to some broadcasting responsibilities. And we've stayed in touch along the years as you've gotten out of coaching and you've done some different things, broadcasting business. How has your view of Gonzaga changed from the time you took the job until now that you're out of it and looking at it from a different perspective?
So hindsight is way more than 20/20. And all the success that we had at UCLA, inevitably as an assistant, is going to lead towards an opportunity to maybe run your own program. So I, after the second Final Four, had an opportunity with three different job offers at San Diego, Long Beach State, and Santa Clara. Obviously chose Santa Clara. Now, should I have done that for the reasons that I made them then? Probably not. Obviously, you ask anyone right now, we'll go to Long Beach State. I got months in the job at Long Beach State because the guy offered to me and didn't let me go interview at Santa Clara, and he wanted me to have the job at the time, the AD. Months and months was doing, I don't even know if he was working. And here we are, what, today, 16 years later, he still has the job. Like, I almost feel like I should get a residual for months for getting him that job because I didn't get it. He got it because I didn't take it. But that's all here and there. The reason for taking the Santa Clara job, notwithstanding, stepping back and looking at the challenge that was there, which was there in 2007, clearly, was how do we get to, and again, the naive view is, okay, we got to beat Gonzaga. Or Gonzaga, as I'm going to take so much flack for the way that I say it, but I have to.
You're an East
I'll
coaster.
Say, I'll say it. GU to cover my butt, but. I do it to poke fun at my guys. They know I know, but it's a little bit of the East Coast dialect. So, yeah, and again, if you think back to our first home game in 2007, I think actually at the time, 2007-08 season, it happened in 2008. And, you know, you have all these ideas, you want to build a program, you think you have buy-in, you think you have support. You know, staff is intact. I got clear West Coast Conference background. My first three assistants were from San Diego, Santa Clara, St. Mary's. We had the conference enveloped in terms of an understanding of it. And, yeah, I mean, everyone as a competitor wants to unseat the giant. But in all honesty, the right thing to do is what Randy do, is just try to finish second and win a few games here and there. And, oh, by the way, Randy's only won 11 games against GO in his career too. So it's not like everybody's got this figured out. Randy's had as much success as anyone in that league outside of Mark. He's only beaten Mark 11 times, to my knowledge, if my math is right. So it's like, let's not fool ourselves into thinking you're going to finish first or even beat them, you know, once, let alone twice a year, if not have a chance to play them three times. So I always go back to that first game, and I'll never forget them walking out of the locker room. Okay, here it is. Now I'll give two pictures. The first one is the present one in 2007. Like, all right. Now this is what I'm talking about. Now we got a chance. Like, it's a good sized gym. It fits. There's atmosphere in here. There's buildup. Clearly, this is the game. Yeah, all right. And you get juiced up. The players get juiced up. I mean, it's hot in there. Like, it's what you're used to in the kennel all the time, right? And lo and behold, we got the damn game won with 39 minutes and 57 seconds off the clock. It's our ball. Like, it's, oh, like, I'm saying to myself, like, all right, we got, like, I'm thinking, again, we got a chance. All the stuff that transpired out of that, which, by the way, set the table for almost damn near every home game I had with Mark since. And I think to a man, he'll tell you this too. He actually told me this 2 years ago after the UW game in December. I was up in his office with a buddy of mine. He's like, I'm so glad you're not in this league anymore. I was like, what do you mean you're so glad? I was like, I won one game against you. Like, why wouldn't you want me back in this league? It's like, nah, your games were terrible and hard. But I was, yeah, whatever. So I think back to that game, and I don't know if you remember, Brody Angley was our point guard that I inherited that year as a senior. It was really him and John Bryant were the only two all-league type players we had. Brody's dad had passed away when I got the job of a cancer battle and was really a big part of the program. They're somewhat local, came to every game. It was just kind of that parent that kind of inserts himself into the fabric of the team and kind of paints the picture of Brody as a leader, like bringing the family atmosphere. Jamie was such a big part of that. And clearly he was at the tail end of his battle with cancer. And the first thing I had to do after I got the job was by myself drive 500 miles round trip up to Reading to go tell his dad, one, I'm your son's coach. That's, by the way, Brody was ineligible when I got there because they had given him the quarter off to go stay with his dad. And he fell so far behind in his academics that if we didn't get it taken care of in the spring quarter, he was going to be ineligible for my first season. So the first thing I had to do was go tell his dad, like, look, I'm not here to tell you anything but tell you one thing. Your son's going to graduate from Santa Clara. I know this current circumstance. I just want you to know that. I'm not saying anything about basketball. The first thing I'm going to tell you is he's going to graduate from Santa Clara. It was a really poignant moment, I think, that connected myself and Brody heading into that season. And if you think back to the first game we played, which I'm not sure if it was the first or second one, might have been the second one, Brody got knocked out of that game by Cuso on a screen. Like blindside, concussion, done, out. So he missed that opportunity. But the one opportunity he had to, as a senior, to beat GU at home, his last home game, right? He was so intent on having the ball in his hands at the end of the game to be that guy that when we couldn't inbound the ball to him on a stationary press offense, it was, hey, throw the ball deep, we'll touch it, 3 seconds, they got no timeouts. If they hit intercepted a three-quarter court shot, more power to him. Probably not going to happen. Let's roll the dice. Well, that gets accomplished. Our guy touches it. Brody was as close to you, close to the inbounder as I am to you on the screen, and the guy didn't want to hand it to him. He got a technical, and he was kind of – so he threw it. I always tell a joke about I'm standing watching the ball in the air, and out of nowhere, here comes Brody Angley like Usain Bolt because he wanted to get – because the kid had tipped the ball, and it was going out of bounds right across from me. Under a second – tenth of a second, all of a sudden here comes Brody and the whistle blows and Brody takes out Stephen Gray, who was just trying to go pick up the ball to do something with it. Because I don't know if it was going out off of him or my guy, but it was 0.3 seconds. And, of course, he hits the two free throws. We go to overtime, go to a second overtime, and lose the game. And I'm literally like beside my, to this day, I'm still beside myself because of the 8 losses that I had to Mark at home. The total number was 56 points. And then I got these jokers in town who are always poking shots at me, reminding me what's going on now that I've been gone. And then when Mark hung 56-point loss on in one game, I'm like, oh, shit. It took him, yeah, he's doing a great job. It took him 1 year to get 56 points. It took me 8 years to get 56 points worth of a loss. But every game we played, I mean, Dower hits the three. Like, come on, Sam Dower hits a pop three off Kyle, is it Draganis, you know, making a backwards pass. And then A-Rop gets a freaking rebound out of the corner and puts it back because no one's like, I remember all these plays like they're freaking yesterday because we could have very easily been, you know, 8-1 at home as opposed to one game we didn't do have as close, but 8-1 as opposed to 1-8. Now the game's up in the kettle, forget about it. And this is what fast forwards me to the respect that we talked about is you got no chance to win up there unless everything goes right. And we had 2 years to do that, both 1 year with Brown Ridge and Foster's senior year. And Foster had that run where he scored 10 points in like 15 seconds. Like, okay, a man's on right now. Let's keep feeding him and let's see what happens. Let's roll it. We know how that goes. And, you know, thinking back to taking the job, there was probably too much time spent on my part on thinking, how can we beat them, especially after that first game, knowing how close you were and knowing the other game up at the kennel was a little bit of an anomaly because Brody got knocked down. We were playing with a walk-on backup point guard. We had no chance. We lost by like 50. And that year, actually, we got matched up with GU in the semis at San Diego and only lost by 4. We had a chance to beat him again. Brody was healthy, and the kid that played backup for us actually got some time. And I think it was Mike Wood was standing in front of Mark on the bench as he called a block on Ben Dowdle that could have easily been a charge that clearly Mark made the call. You know, like, I get it. And I say that now, like, I just say it because I can. But we were that close to beating them in 2008 on San Diego's campus before it moved to Orleans. So the first year kind of set a stage for me, like, you know what? We're this far away in finances, and we're probably that far away in talent, but we're, like, this far away to figuring out how to beat them with what we have. Like, we're damn close. And it just grew into becoming an understanding of the logistics of the conference and everything that Mike and Mark had set up there, getting a little bit of the backstory about what happened in the 90s where the school was close to going out of business and the 99 team kind of awoke the president and the administration into starting a program. That, you know, all the things that have now become, you know, historical lore up in Spokane, it just shows that there's so much more that goes into building a program that can sustain that level of success than just having talent on the floor. But it's also a byproduct in that it's easier to sell that talent on the past success, but also on this incredible infrastructure. And now what's happened is the transition into the new building, which they made an unbelievable decision to not expand and make bigger. Anyone else would have said, okay, let's make it 10,000. No, no, you know who you are. Like, that's, I think if there's anything I take away from my understanding of Spokane, of Gonzaga, is they know who they are and they don't try to be anything that they're not. And they let everything that happens naturally occur all the way to the point now where they're not just the best team in your conference. They're one of the 5 best teams in the country. So what was here when I got there is now no shot. They I mean, like, the all-time upset of upsets will be when they don't win the league. Like, if somehow BYU now and St. Mary's gets a run where they catch them twice and those guys only lose one game. Like, anyone that wins the WCC outright in the regular season right now, last 10, 15 year biggest upset in college basketball. Because there's just so much else that goes into it that the other schools are not prepared to do. There is a level of buy-in there that has to be unilateral that takes a lot of sacrifice and foresight and a lot of trust in a guy like Mark to have his staff prepared to enact that to get the type of talent they need to get. And we don't need to sit here and wax on how that's been from a transfer standpoint, starting with you and early on, into the overseas element, to now they're friggin' signing McDonald's All-Americans and beating out Dukes and Carolinas and Kentuckys and Kansas for guys. Like, it's an unbelievable story. And yeah, it's great to write about, tweet about stuff, but having lived it and been right in the middle of that growth, in the middle of, you know, in the mid-2000s here, to where it's now elevated to a national stage, man, it's exciting to see. It's something that, you know, I love to watch, love to commentate on. You know, I think I did a game on one of my clients, Hot Mic, where you're able to put your own commentary on a live game and people can listen to it. And I thought about doing it for the 06 game, but I didn't because I was too invested in the UCLA side. I don't want to lose my Spokane folks, but certainly anticipate doing that because I want to give those folks more of a perspective of how there is that level of respect. You know, I think, you know, the Slippers Still Fit guys and the Free Ira Brown guys, you know, the people that support the program, even on whatever level they're on, they're always going to have that little chip on their shoulder, like, you know, don't come at us, bro. Like, come on. You know, like, you don't respect us. Like, nah, I think that chip is a little bit polished now. I mean, there's a level of respect outside of there that puts your alma mater in a very, very high regard. And no better example of that than their recent recruiting class. And now it's not – look, the best programs don't – rebuild, they reload, and now they're in reloading. They had a rebuilding part, and I always joked with Mark that the greatest trick he ever played was convincing Elias Harris that staying in Spokane was better than going in the lottery. To this day, if I ever have a chance to go learn how to fly fish for one day and I'm standing in a river, that might be the only thing I ask Mark. Like, all right, look, cut the crap. Don't give me any of the meat. This is you and me talking and the fish. I'm not taking it anywhere. I need to know how you convinced Elias Harris to come back to school after his freshman year, because he was going in the first half of the draft. And then he stayed there for what? Did he stay there for 4 years?
4 years, yeah.
Yeah, like, Mark, you got to be kidding me. And, like, I'm on my side, like, thinking, like, okay, well, that's one less guy we got to worry about. Like, oh, he's coming back. Oh, he's still here. Oh, freak. Now he's a senior playing with Olynyk. Like, how do you beat these guys? Like, there's no shot. You got no chance from a talent standpoint. So I love talking about it because I just think it's such a unique story. And, yeah, I got respect for the Butlers of the world. And, you know, keep in mind, I grew up in a program that, albeit in the Big East, made an unprecedented march to the national championship game in 1989 at Seton Hall that was not ever expected to do that. So I have an appreciation for that. But I have really a great appreciation, I think, if I say one thing to end this thought on, is I think Mike Roth doesn't get enough shine. I think Mike Roth needs to get a lot more credit for what he's doing nationally, and he wouldn't want it that way, and I think that's one reason why it stays that way up there. But for him to manage that, to set the program up for success, to spread it out to all the other programs in the department to have success, to piggyback off it and not cannibalize one for the other, I think Mike's done a tremendous job. And clearly, as much as Mark should be there and will be there most likely for life, you got a guy in Mike Roth that could easily have promoted himself into a Power 5 job as an administrator and didn't. I think that's admirable and clearly a big, big part of why there's so much success continually up there.
I love the backstory and I love the respect. Last question before I let you go. I know you're involved in some different things now. You do some broadcasting for pre- and post-game for Golden State Warriors games. You're also working for a sports marketing firm that you – sounded very excited about, and you love the role that you have before we started recording our conversation. Do you see coaching in your future again, or are you happy with where you're at?
I got that question over the last 4 years. I went so far as almost beg every Pac-12 school that had an opening to be an assistant. And selfishly, I've reflected on that lack of ability to infiltrate that again as a sign of respect that I don't view you as an assistant coach. You know, you're a head coach. You're a successful head coach. I mean, heck, if you know, again, hindsight again, heck, if you had taken the Long Beach State job, you'd probably be a head coach at UCLA right now. Like, okay, speculation is one thing, but I'm willing to get back into this to help a team be successful. And I don't care about accolades and who's getting paid what. I love coaching. Like, I love I was raised as a coach. My father was a coach, moved into athletic administration. Like, I have an inherent need to teach people. My mom was a teacher. You know, I coached fourth grade basketball this year. It was the first time I coached basketball team, my son's fourth grade junior team. And I was coaching that team like we were, you know, trying to beat GU. Like, it's just – and I wasn't over the top with it. I just was so encouraging and so excited, like, when a kid made a great pass or when he used the backboard or when he jump stopped or when we had kids pivoting instead of traveling and double dribbling. I took so much pride in that. It reminded me of what my root is, and it's success in helping others. And really the parallel into what a successful business is rooted in a lot of these coaching techniques, you know, to build your business, to have the right associates, to have the right C-suite, to have the right advisors. I mean, there are so many parallels in business and college basketball. And clearly, you know, I said this before, you know, the Jay Wrights and the Mike Krzyzewskis and the Bill Self's of the world that have had this Hall of Fame level success because it's worked for them and have written books about it are sought after to impart that successful wisdom on the highest level of companies. But I take some solace in the fact that we've had success at the highest level as an assistant, right on the doorstep as a head coach, but then I think built record notwithstanding, a pretty successful program at Santa Clara to the point where, I don't know, Dan, we didn't even talk about this. We won two postseason championships and didn't lose a game. Like, we've only been to the postseason twice, and both of those teams accepted that role. And this is what I think I take the most out of from a basketball standpoint. Take the record out in those games we talk about, GU. We won two postseason championships in tournaments that, by and large, a lot of people kind of dismiss, the CIT, the CBI, hey, you got to pay to get this game if you want to have it at home. Like, all right, yeah, it's not the NCAA, it's not the NIT, but hey, I've been in the NCAA Final Four twice. I've been in the championship game. I was on a bench that won the NIT, and here I am now. No one's been in these four tournaments. So taking that success and cultivating a team to embrace that tournament, like, that's the one thing I think our staff did a phenomenal job was, hey, yeah, it's the CIT, but we're building this. Hey, next year it could be the NIT. Year after, like, that's easy to see. But this is the position we're in right now. This is where we can be one of four teams in the entire country to finish their season with a winning game, with a win at the end of the season. We did that twice. Taking that into business and having a chance to do it at all different levels successfully and have the patience to, like I said before, pivot if needed to, or just wait to take the right proper steps to get to the next step and don't skip a step. I inadvertently, and we started this whole conversation off with relationships. One of the relationships I made at Santa Clara my first year to the former manager that runs a financial management program. He's helping our family keep our TIA, CREF, and our 401k in order. So, you know, plug and play. Great trusted friend. What's now almost 4 months ago, he knows what we've been doing with our Vinculum group, which was our own deal of just kind of connecting one off. And he says, you should talk to my friend Eric. Eric is my assistant coach for my Little League team. Well, Eric is the CEO of JMI Sports, who moved up to Menlo right here in the middle of the peninsula in Silicon Valley a year and a half ago to plant a flag in Silicon Valley to connect technology companies and the Valley to his properties at JMI Sports, which is rooted in sponsorship sales and marketing to support the great client list of Kentucky, Clemson, Notre Dame, Pittsburgh, Georgia, the Ivy League, the entire Ivy League, along with Penn, Columbia, and Harvard individually, the Patriot League, the Mountain West, and now the Mid-American Conference. These entities that they're able to connect businesses to, yes, for sponsorship opportunities, but also for opportunities to connect those campuses to those companies directly. And he says, you should talk to them. We go up and have coffee half an hour in January. 3 hours later, he says, well, I'm starting an agency here. How'd you like to come? Help me head it up. I'm like, game on. Literally a month later, I was already planning to send my wife to Austin, Texas to look at real estate to think, okay, why are we killing ourselves from a living standpoint here in San Jose? We can get the kind of the same thing accomplished in Austin. I'd been to Austin 6 times in the last year, loved it, and thought it was the second best place for me to be at. Well, the day she's supposed to go, I get the offer for the job to be full-time to be a VP of business development at JMI the day before, take the offer. That was on February 26th. And obviously March 1st was the starting day. And we ended up obviously staying. She never went to Austin. And then all of a sudden we're in this lockdown situation. So it's been a whirlwind, but an unbelievably great time to discover the opportunity. Couldn't be more thankful to Eric Judson, the CEO of JMI Sports. And I think we're primed to do some really, really cool things because, as you mentioned, Dan, I'm bringing a mindset from the other side first, having been on the collegiate side, and then a little bit on the higher level side of what these companies like JMI can do for your program and for your department and maybe your campus. In the case of Clemson in Kentucky, we have entire campus rights. We're doing stuff with an innovation center in Kentucky. It would be the last place if I asked you to name 10 schools that have an esports connection to their innovation center on campus. Kentucky might be one of the last places. Like, JMI is really pushing the envelope to expose a lot of great brands. But now with this flag planted in Silicon Valley, one, it keeps me here. I don't have to commute back from Texas to do my Warriors games when they come back on. But two, it also gives me a chance to accentuate these relationships that I've built, not only in basketball and the collegiate side through this unbelievable Rolodex that I'm afforded the opportunity to have, but now this Rolodex of venture capitalists and startups and CEOs and companies and people that really don't know how to connect to these campuses. And really, to be honest with you, Dan, never thought about doing it. It's an opportunity creator. That all goes back to the beginning of our conversation of recruiting kids to give them an opportunity to be the very best they can be in an environment that suits them. This is almost to a man exactly what this is on a business level. So I'm super excited about the opportunity. It keeps me in the mindset of connecting, of building, of helping, of guiding. It keeps me in that servant leadership mode that I even took as a head coach with my staff to help others as much as possible. And it gives me a chance to obviously spend maybe a little bit more time with the kids in coaching wood while they're in third and fifth grade, while also staying attached. Like, the first call I made was to Mike Bray at Notre Dame. I say, Mike, just to let you know, it hasn't been announced yet, but I'm taking a spot with JMI. Oh, that's great. That's phenomenal. And, of course, what does Mike do? Let's get you out here, get you to a football game, come watch us practice, tell us how bad we are, put some eyes on it. So that's not part of my job description, but Eric clearly understands there are strong relationships in place already on the campuses he has, but across the collegiate landscape that I can maybe help him with. But I also look forward into helping them get connected to these companies. It's one-of-a-kind opportunity that's a little bit of a blank slate that we're starting to paint and fill in now, and really excited to see where it can take us.
Well, sounds like you've hit your sweet spot. Post-coaching career, you might get back into it at some point, but it probably is going to have to be a perfect opportunity. Coach, I appreciate the time. It was great hearing the stories you had from your UCLA and your Santa Clara days, and as well as a little bit of your perspective of Gonzaga. So, Coach, I really appreciate these times and look forward to connecting again at some point in the near future.
Absolutely. Appreciate the opportunity. Then next time, music and coffee, man. We got to have more personal conversations.
Sounds good to me. All right.
All right, bro. Have a good one. Thank you.